Hello and welcome to the TES News Podcast. I'm your host, Mary Louise Clues. Joining me this week, we have reporter Amy Gibbons. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
And reporter Catherine Love. Hi, Catherine.
Hello.
Hi.
And last but definitely not least, we have news editor Will Stewart. Hi, Will.
Hello.
So today, we'll be talking about how school leaders are warning the supply of headteachers is at risk of collapse, and how the Prime Minister has said education is a national priority as we emerge from the pandemic. But first, I want to talk about an important new investigation unveiled on our site this morning, looking at the potential end of pen and paper exams as preparations are made to move GCSEs and A-levels online. There's a huge amount of coverage about the nuts and bolts of this move on our website today, but the key revelation from Catherine's coverage is that the DfE wanted to move this summer's exams online. Apparently, the exam boards were approached by officials last autumn about this possibility. Catherine, clearly this was not backed by the boards, otherwise we'd be looking at a very different landscape for exams this summer. But what I'm interested to know is, why were they so emphatic in their response to the DfE that this wouldn't be possible to turn around?
I think predominantly it was timing, and the fact that they were obviously being asked to do that at quite a late stage. So it's before the exams were cancelled, but in autumn 2020, being asked whether they could then roll something out for GCSEs for summer 2021. And I think, you know, having spoken to the boards about the kinds of programs that they have and the things that they're piloting for digital assessment, it's not necessarily that the technology is that far away in terms of doing this. But I think, you know, that there were obviously kind of quite a lot of logistical issues. For example, would schools have technology in place to run these exams? And, you know, would they have the connectivity to do this? And the fact that, you know, before any exam like that is rolled out on a national scale, it has to be piloted and trialed. So I think, you know, it's not as though it would necessarily take years and years to introduce this, but I think within that space of time that there would have to be more stages that you'd go through. And one of the big things that was raised by everyone I spoke to was, are schools ready and do they have the kind of the infrastructure to introduce something like that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, this seems to go to the heart of what your brilliant series of articles has shone the light on, doesn't it, Catherine? So it seems that the technological infrastructure is ready on the exam board side. Of course, lots of them run exams online internationally. But schools need the funding, and there needs to be the political will from the government to get ready to make this switch. Is that right?
I think so, absolutely, because it was interesting. As part of this series, I spoke to the head of Alpha Plus, which is the company that was involved in rolling out online assessments in Wales. Now, I have to say that they're not kind of final end of year exams. They are sort of for students in years two to year nine, and they're kind of formative online tests that teachers can use to kind of see how much progress students are making, what they need to teach them next. So it's quite different to GCSEs and A-levels. But the key thing is that was rolled out for all students in the country, and now 98% of students in those year groups sit those online tests. So it does sort of show that it is possible to do if the decision is made to do it. And I think the Welsh government kind of essentially made that decision and then said, well, we can't have schools without the connectivity because otherwise this won't work. So then they invested in order that all schools would have that. And you know, also kind of when I spoke with the president of ASCOL, Richard Sheriff, he also made the point that, you know, that a lot of schools are in England are moving that way in terms of kind of their technical capabilities. So like academy chains will, you know, roll out, for example, tablets and devices for their students. So I think, you know, there are questions over how ready schools are, but I think it would just take that bit of investment in order to kind of start to make this happen.
It also occurred to me that, and you definitely mentioned this in the investigation, I thought it was really interesting, not only are schools kind of ready to deliver exams in this way, but will there be the access there for students? And obviously something that's come up over the course of the pandemic. I wonder whether the department has been delivering, obviously there's been lots of controversy surrounding it, but huge numbers of laptops have ended up with schools. So could this potentially be a use in the years to come for all of that technology that was sent out to schools during the pandemic? And I think I remember reading in the piece that this was a concern among some people you spoke to, that students, not only might schools not be ready, but, you know, students might not perhaps have the same sort of digital capability as others as well. Like, some might be more comfortable using technology than other students who perhaps haven't grown up with it in the house. So, I just thought that was an interesting point.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think that is where, you know, I mentioned before that the idea of time. And I think not only when you're introducing a new assessment, not only do you need kind of the time to actually get that assessment ready, but also you obviously need to get kind of students in classrooms used to using that kind of paper. I mean, with pen and paper exams, having been a teacher, like, you try and get the students as used as possible to what the exam paper looks like. And so if you are going to introduce something like that, then I think that is a really serious concern that would need to be looked at, is how would it advantage students that have their own personal computer at home or have that kind of typing speed or capability? And for other students, if they don't have that, does that just, you know, widen the digital divide? So I think definitely that needs to be looked at. If it were possible to use some of these laptops that have now arrived in schools to start to do this, I think that'd be really good idea.
That's what I'm thinking. Like, could they be setting more tasks and kind of practice exams and stuff using that technology that students have been given during the pandemic to help them prepare sort of more effectively? I wonder if that's a possibility. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I think so.
I was going to say, I thought it was an amazing piece of work. The two takeaways for me were, one, it just felt really naive almost from the DfE's point of view to think that you could just drop everything. It felt like there's a bit of a gulf of understanding between what's involved, and maybe you'd expect that. But then the other thing that you really seem to draw out is that there seems to be a change now, a change in attitude, which I guess is a key thing going forward, that you might expect change to come sooner than it would have done otherwise because of COVID.
Mm. Yeah, I think definitely there is. I think you're right on the kind of the naivety that, you know, that asking that question in autumn when it's never been done before is definitely seems very unrealistic. But in terms of actually kind of long term after the pandemic, you know, it does sound that there has been this change of tone in government, and that there's been this kind of realization that if they had had something set up like this where they could have run exams online, at least maybe some of them, then they would have had that kind of bit more resilience in the system, and they wouldn't have had to kind of cancel exams wholesale. And it also kind of, it's a bit like the fact that, you know, people have been now questioning the whole idea of GCSEs and assessment in general during the pandemic. I think, you know, there is a sort of sense that, well, is after all this, you know, has happened, is it a time to kind of take stock and look at the ways students are examined at the moment? And a lot of the people I spoke to, you know, have made the point that the way we assess is very old fashioned. And I think, you know, there is some credibility to that argument that, you know, I know obviously the whole idea of 21st century skills is very polemical in education, and that whole idea of, you know, whether the idea of a knowledge-based curriculum is also very polemical. But I think that in terms of just the structure of an exam where students are going in with one paper, sat at one time, the exams are kind of delivered and then kept under lock and key, I think, you know, a lot of the people I spoke to were like, well, why use that system? Because in any kind of setting after you leave school, you don't have that kind of setup, and that isn't the way you sort of show your knowledge about something.
I guess in a way that might be what holds it back slightly, because, you know, to make the most of it, maybe government actually won't want to open that kind of Pandora's box of rethinking everything. You know, they are very keen to hang on to GCSEs, aren't they? So maybe in the end that would leave them clinging on to what they know. I don't know.
No, I think, I mean, I think it raises all sorts of like really interesting possibilities. So the kind of the kinds of pilots that have been done by exam boards at the moment do look very similar to pen and paper exams. They look, you know, they might be on screen, but they're not really adaptive, and they are very similar to what you might see in a kind of printed paper format. But as the technology develops, they could potentially be adaptive. The tests I mentioned before that are sat in Wales are adaptive. And I think that does raise some really interesting ideas about how you would grade students. Like Richard Cherif from Askell, for example, mentioned that if you did have adaptive online testing, that would be the end of a tiered paper. So you wouldn't have tiered papers anymore. Like this, the test would adapt as the student answered questions. And, you know, also obviously with pen and paper exams and the system we've got at the moment, with norm referencing, you have that third of students who don't pass GCSE maths and English every year. And, you know, it's interesting to think, well, if there were an online system, would that change somewhat? And actually it would be more about perhaps getting a transcript of what skills you do have and what skills maybe you don't, and then taking that forward to employers. And would that be a bit fairer than just sort of having that cutoff of, you know, you didn't get your grade 4, so you've got to reset, kind of thing.
So I guess that brings us to our final question on this is around timing, Catherine. So when do we expect to see the system come screeching into the 21st century? Are we talking 2022 next year, or is it going to take a bit longer? What are the experts telling you?
I don't think it would be 2022, but it does seem like it wouldn't necessarily have to be that far away to start doing this. So, you know, all the boards I spoke to, you mentioned that it would have to be trialled, it would have to be piloted, schools would have to sort of almost pretend to run an online GCSE and see how that worked. And so, you know, there would need to be lead-in time. There would also need to be time kind of in terms of getting students used to those devices and used to the idea of doing a different form of assessment. For example, so Colin Hughes, chief executive of AQA, said, you know, that like you would need to do the pilots for maybe 2 to 3 years, but then after that, potentially you could introduce it for some subjects. And so I think, as you were sort of saying before, that it's a little bit about the possibly more about government making the decision to do it. And then if they did decide to go down that route, then maybe trial it with a few subjects at first. Potentially, you know, it's not that far away because the technology is sort of there, perhaps not for like kind of fully adaptive testing, but the technology is certainly there to start thinking about how you put different subjects online.
Well, thanks for that, Catherine. All of that is available on our website to read.
And lots more to come. There's like there's 3 good articles today, and Catherine's written a lot more, so look out for that in the coming days as well.
Thanks for that, Catherine. So for all of this to work, of course, all of these reforms to go ahead, we need experienced and committed head teachers, Amy. I know that you covered a story today from School Leaders Union NAHT, which focused on a survey they did among school leaders that revealed that less than half of heads would recommend their job to others. It's pretty shocking. They've also warned of a potential collapse in the supply of its school leaders based on its findings, which also revealed that nearly half of assistant and deputy heads, 46%, don't want to become school leaders. That seems pretty shocking figures. Do you think the attitude of school leaders has been affected by the COVID pandemic and kind of having to juggle that over the past year, Amy?
Yeah, it's not a huge vote of confidence in kind of how in the government and how it's kind of handled the profession over the years. I think COVID has certainly had an impact, and actually the NAHT did have some kind of specific findings on this that were quite interesting. So kind of it exposed the impact of the crisis on headship specifically. So about 7 in 10 leaders said they were less content in their role than they were a year ago. And actually those top 3 words that they used to describe their experience of the last year were challenging, exhausting and stressful. Very, very negative connotations with all of that. And I think it doesn't as you say, it doesn't bode well sort of for future supply. The other statistic that the NAHT came out with, that they kind of warned of this kind of lack of trust and autonomy in leaders and how kind of that's been corrosive over recent sort of times. So about three quarters of the people, just under, that they asked, they cited frequently changing government guidance on COVID specifically as the biggest management challenge of the last year. Now, heads have been up against like an extraordinary challenge over the last year. So the fact that three quarters say this government guidance, changing guidance, has been their biggest management challenge is really worrying. And it goes to show the government's got quite a lot of work to do to rebuild that trust if the supply is going to continue going forward.
It seems that the COVID boost, the much and often quoted COVID boost in teacher recruitment on one end, is not being seen at the top end of the profession. Does the union have any recommendations on how this can be fixed, Amy?
Yeah, so they kind of set out five key recommendations for the government on things that they can do to kind of help with the situation. They include things like ending what they call centralised diktats from Whitehall that they say don't take account of school leaders' experience and expertise. That's a really, really important one for them. Also reforming the pay structure. This was something that came into the survey as well. Leaders citing concerns around pay. They want to reinstate the pay differential for leadership. They think that will be beneficial. And another one that I picked out was that they want to the government to provide training, mentoring and support for new and existing leaders. Now, this is interesting because there's been quite a lot in the news this week. I've reported on that the new early career framework guidance for schools, and there's a huge emphasis in that framework on the role of the mentor and supporting teachers early on in their career. Now, I have heard it said by some that this needs to continue right through the career. You know, it's not just about the first few years. Teachers need the support throughout their career, and it looks like this is something that the NAHT think will help with the leadership supply challenge, you know, making sure that support remains in place so teachers don't just kind of end up being left, you know, without any help beyond a certain point.
Was it all, it's obviously a warning of what might happen. I mean, the thing that struck me when I read this does sound shocking, and it must be pretty very tough, I imagine, being a head teacher at the moment, so I wouldn't want to take anything away from that. However, I wrote a story on pretty much the same thing happening every year for about the past 17 years. So I thought, well, is it really happening? But I think there have been figures, haven't they, Sean? I think primary schools really do struggle to recruit heads now, particularly in rural areas where they move on. Were there any figures showing what's actually happened in terms of the supply already drying up?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I'm just looking through kind of what the general findings were. I mean, I don't remember there being anything about supply kind of already drying up. There's a lot about how heads wouldn't recommend their role, and also how those who are in those deputy and assistant roles, as Mary Lee mentioned earlier, not aspiring to headship. So you can sort of see down the line how that might happen. And you've also got a statistic in there, nearly half, 47% of leaders said they were less likely to stay in leadership for as long as they had planned. So we know the COVID crisis has been in some ways beneficial in that it's boosted teacher recruitment and it's also boosted teacher retention to some extent. But I think it's what happens beyond the initial kind of shock of the crisis, and what the NAHT are warning is that this could lead to an exodus, they say, of leaders. But we'll see. I think time will tell sort of what the true impact is.
The pay differential you were talking about, is that how much the fact, because there is some differential, isn't there? Is that just saying how much you can earn now as a classroom teacher and that it's coming close to headship? Is that what it is? Or
yeah, so the NAHT described it as the erosion of leaders' real pay, undermining future supply. They said that 4 in 10 assistant and deputy heads see pay as a barrier to promotion. So you're right, you know, looking at moving up. And the majority believe differentiated pay awards have had a negative impact on aspiration to the role. So it's all about what kind of motivation they have to move up the ladder. And it looks like actually it's not particularly high or quite as high as you would like to. I mean, you'd hope people in deputy and assistant roles, you know, they want to continue to progress and kind of move up to that top role. So the fact that that's not happening is, I think, concerning. And that's what the NAHT is highlighting.
It's sort of, I suppose it sort of shows that need for like much, much more support and possibly like a kind of further look at that differential pay as well. Because, you know, if the general consensus is that, you know, that the the situation over the last year has required so much more work. And as you said, you know, Head's using the words of it being challenging, it being stressful, it being really difficult, and then sort of perhaps not feeling that remunerated for that additional stress, then yeah, you can understand how the people maybe in the deputy roles who are kind of just below them might think, well actually that doesn't, you know, that doesn't look like something they want to go for.
Absolutely, yeah.
The one thing that we haven't talked about, which I guess might be a factor, I don't know if they mentioned it, is it must have changed a lot, the headship role, in the last 10 years, because you're having to manage upwards now, because you're so often you're going to be part of a mat. So, you know, you had all that stress of being a head teacher and everything that comes with it, but at least previously you had autonomy and, you know, you were in charge of what your school was doing, where it was going. You might have governors, but that was usually a partnership. Whereas now I can imagine working under, you know, some mats that keep quite tight reins on their schools, it must be, well, frustrating if you're used to having that degree of freedom.
Yeah, I don't think it that's a really good point. That one, I mean, it wasn't mentioned specifically in this report, but I think it would definitely be relevant. I think the other thing that came up, which would not be a surprise to people who have lived through the last year, is this idea of work-life balance and concerns about personal well-being. It's obviously been an extremely stressful year for everybody, and I think that is also playing a part in kind of people's decisions about whether they might want to move up to the next, you know, the next stage. So 75% of assistants and deputies said that concerns about work-life balance were a key reason for preventing them from seeking a head teacher position. So it's not looking like a particularly attractive position to lots of people at the moment. And I think that's obviously what we'll need to change in order to keep that supply kind of running through. It was some interesting, slightly, or well, more than slightly concerning findings, I think.
Well, maybe we'll see some of those, see the political will coming through to listen to some of those concerns and recommendations coming from leadership and from teachers. Just brings us on to our third story I wanted to focus on this week, is the revelation that education is now the biggest priority for the country, according to Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who said on Tuesday at the Downing Street briefing that he recognised the coronavirus crisis had caused an absolutely unimaginable year for everybody in education. Argued the loss of learning is the thing we've got to focus on now as a society. Now, this statement that education is the biggest priority for the country coming out of the pandemic, well, you think that's a significant statement?
I think it could be. Amy spotted it. I mean, straight away we thought, blimey, that's quite, I mean, to put it in context, it was in the middle of, it wasn't his kind of opening statement in this Downing Street briefing. It was in questions, but it was almost, I don't know if you knew what the question was or not, but it was all, there was a lot of it. And it made me think a few things. I think the first thing, because he was talking so much about catch up and how much had to be done, I don't think you'd be making that kind of lengthy statement if you didn't have something in mind and, you know, you didn't think that you were going to make some kind of big commitment. So, you know, we've heard about the initial catch-up program, but I think they've already hinted and trailed the fact that it's going to lead to something much bigger. So I think that was the first thing I thought, you know, what's coming down the line must be a pretty big deal for him to be going out on a limb like that. And I think the other thing, I wondered if it was a bit of a Blair moment. You know, obviously everybody remembers when Tony Blair said what were his top, he said, if I was asked what my top three priorities for government were, there'll be education, education, education. And this, it might not have been as snappy, but it seemed to be, you know, it's almost as big a commitment. And that got me thinking as to whether we think the Johnson government's in a position to, or is likely to back up those words. I think, I mean, with Blair, I was thinking about what the Blair government did. I think the one thing you could say is it put a huge amount of money into education. You know, it took a while to turn the taps on, but when it did, schools did feel like they had a lot of cash.
One of my first thoughts on this, I mean, when I heard it all, also saw it mentioned in the briefing, and it was, as you say, sort of sandwiched in with other questions, but stuck out like a sore thumb to me, because that is a pretty big thing to say, you know, being the biggest priority, is that I think these sorts of statements, they have come out before, Boris Johnson talking about how important catch-up is. I'm taking them with a slight pinch of salt, because up until this point, we've had a couple of promises made by this government. Obviously, during the pandemic, so that's kind of interrupted things, which is, you know, fair enough. But we know that there was this promise that teachers' pay would be moved up to, starting pay would be moved up to 30,000 by 2022. And obviously that pledge has since been dropped. And not only that, but we've got the, if we're looking at the pledges that have been made over the course of the pandemic itself, I mean, we had the government promising £350 million for the National Tutoring Programme for the first year of the programme. And as it turned out, we kind of did some digging into this and later revealed that that money was going to be spread over 2 years, not one. So the government's record on sort of pledges for education over the course of not only the crisis, but before that too, haven't always kind of manifested. And I think it's great that they're showing kind of willing and you know, education is coming up. But I don't know if that will necessarily translate into kind of guaranteed pay uplifts and that sort of thing, as Will mentions, that spending.
Yeah.
I totally agree. It's the flip side, isn't it? He loves to make a big statement, doesn't he? But yeah, it's whether it adds up to anything.
I completely agree with what you were saying there. And I think the other thing, when as well as the kind of the funding issues, like it doesn't feel as of yet, and maybe they will introduce other ideas, but this hasn't been a government, obviously they've had to deal with the pandemic, but this hasn't been a government that's kind of put in really a lot of kind of significant educational reforms. So, or kind of mentioned that before. So it seems quite strange to kind of, unless there's sort of something forthcoming, it doesn't seem like that's been their focus.
That's what it made me wonder, though, because at the same time, you have had Gavin Williamson hint about, well, not hint, he's just come out and said it. You know, he thinks now is time for kind of a change in line with what happened after the First World War, Second World War and the Beveridge Report.
Yeah.
And, you know, it all seems to be, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, they're talking about cutting the summer holidays down or changes to the school day, all the signs are that they've got something that they think is quite a big deal in mind, which made me wonder. But I think you're right, though. I mean, like, in terms of real change, like, everybody's saying change GCSEs. It's a perfect time to do it. And what's Gavin Williamson said? No.
Absolutely not. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if it was to be a Beveridge moment, I mean, any ideas what they would most likely want to change? Will? I mean, it's a big question, isn't it? But where do you think they would go first?
Well, I mean, I think what they're talking about, I mean, I guess if you were to change the school holiday structure, if you were to cut, it would be perfect for provoking a fight with the teaching unions, which they might think is a good thing. It's a fairly aggressive government in that respect. I mean, there's all sorts of things you could change. I mean, you know, it's kind of right for a year zero. You know, Ofsted has just not done anything for a good year. The exam system, I mean, it's mainly accountability, isn't it? That's just completely gone and the world hasn't ended. So if you wanted to change any of those, then now's the time to do it. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of appetite for that.
They'll be quite spurred on by the fact that the COVID crisis has, at least in the short terms, sort of solved some of the problems for it. The teacher recruitment crisis was a massive problem.
Yeah.
And it's something that the government had been planning to address, obviously, before the pandemic. Well, where are we now? You know, teacher recruitment has gone through the roof. Retention has improved. So those two things, I mean, I'm sure many people have acknowledged that probably won't last forever. But those problems now, you know, great, they can kind of look at other things in addition to that. And I wonder how aspirational they'll be in that regard. But as you say, like, it doesn't look like there's much appetite to change the exam system itself from the government. And that would be kind of one obvious thing that they could overhaul.
And as you've already said, I think it's very hard to make real lasting change if you're not going to put your hand in your pocket. And to be fair to this government, the one thing they would say if they were here was that they have well, they describe it as 14 billion, but I think that's double or triple counting. But they put in like 7.1 billion more money into schools, which they would say, you know, is a huge settlement and that's going to make a big difference. I don't think that's that. I think the difference with the, it takes schools back to roughly where they were before the coalition came in. So it takes them back to where they were under Blair. But I think what changes things is not getting back to things where they were, but it's suddenly when you've got a lot of extra money on top, and then all of a sudden there's like, you know, you've got the time and not the time, you've got the resources to consider doing things differently. Because I think once you've had the money, you just get used to having it, and then having any less just feels like cut. So yeah, I think they put a lot of money in their terms, but their problem is that it doesn't feel like it, does it? I don't think schools feel awash with cash.
And also, yes, there's been these brilliant kind of 1 billion, 1.7 billion funding announcements. But as we've uncovered over the past few weeks and months, not all of that's even new money. And I think that is kind of, some of that has had impact on kind of trust and faith in the government as well, when they haven't been completely honest at every stage about how much of that is coming from existing budgets and how much is coming from the Treasury. I think that would have frustrated people.
And that's the bigger picture, isn't it? There's just not a lot of cash around, is there? Obviously, because it's...
Absolutely.
Furloughing, yeah. Everything.
Yeah. It's not been a cheap year for the government, put it that way. So, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure, well, let's hope there's a big announcement coming and we'll be on that and covering it on the TES News website as it happens. But I think for this week, we've rambled on long enough. As always, all of these stories can be found on our website, tes.com/news. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at TES. And that's all from us. Thanks very much for listening. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.